It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
I'm David Knowles, and this is Ukraine, the latest. Today, we bring you news from across Ukraine, update on a spying scandal in Germany, and we look at the bleak situation for wounded soldiers on the front lines.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's gonna break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Every weekday afternoon, we sit down with leading journalists from the Telegraph's London newsroom and our teams reporting on the ground to bring you the latest news and analysis on the war in Ukraine. It's Thursday, the 18th of April, 2 years and 54 days since the full-scale invasion began. And today I'm joined by our associate editor Dominic Nichols, Berlin correspondent James Rothwell, and our guest is Asami Terayima from the Kyiv Independent. I started by asking Dom for the latest news from Ukraine.
Well, hi, David. Hi, everybody. Welcome, Asami. Lovely to chat to you. So the death toll from the Russian airstrike on Chernihiv in northern Ukraine yesterday risen to 18, officials said this morning. Another 78 wounded when three missiles hit the city centre. That's Russia's deadliest airstrike in weeks. Governor Vyacheslav Chaus said on Telegram that the search and rescue operation was called off this morning. Just to the northeast, Sumy. And Sumy's been attacked again. Russian forces hit the oblast, the area, not just the city, 39 times in 11 separate attacks throughout yesterday, the military administration say there. So throughout the day, Russia hit the border communities with mortar, artillery, drone and guided aerial bomb attacks. Sometimes the drones were dropping explosives on that was noted in a couple of the communities around there. Now, Serezhina Buda is a town said to have a pre-war population of almost 7,000 people. It's in the Sumy area, about 150 k's northeast of Chernihiv. And this town is right on the border with Russia. That's been experiencing the bulk of the attacks over the last 24 hours. Miraculously, no casualties or injuries reported throughout the region. But Russian strikes against Sumy Oblast have become increasingly destructive in recent months, and we may remember that Ukrainian authorities ordered the evacuation of children from 52 settlements throughout the oblast on April the 5th. Now, elsewhere, there are reports from the Ukrainian military, persistent reports, actually, we've mentioned it once before, but these reports are that Russia has ramped up its illegal use of riot control agents on the front lines to try to clear trenches. One Ukrainian infantryman, a call sign Ray, speaking to Reuters, said a drone flying above his trench on the eastern front had dropped a tear gas grenade. Ray said, "It's like pepper spray. It makes your eyes tear up. It's not lethal, but it disturbs and knocks you out. It makes it very difficult to carry out duties once you've inhaled it. I mean, it can be extremely debilitating in large doses. So if it hits you in a small area." riot control agents like tear gas are banned on the battlefield by the International Chemical Weapons Convention, which Russia and Ukraine are signatories to. We see most of this stuff when civilians are hit with tear gas, you know, in riots and protests and what have you in cities. They can all run away and the tear gas, sort of the cloud breaks up. But soldiers stuck in trenches don't have that option. So CS gas, tear gas, is typically heavier than air, so it will sink into trenches and underground bunkers, basements, that kind of thing. It sits in the low-lying ground, which is obviously exactly where the soldiers are. So in those sort of dosages, it can be very, very dangerous indeed. Colonel Serhiy Pakhomov, who's acting head of Ukraine's military, or the Ukrainian military's atomic, biological and chemical defence forces, said Kyiv recorded around 900 uses of riot control agents by Russia in the past 6 months, out of a total of 1,400-ish since the start of the full-scale invasion. Russia's embassy in the Netherlands, where the OPCW, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, is based, back in January, they posted a tweet on X that allegations about Russia's use of grenades with CN gas use unconfirmed data. Russia's defense ministry didn't respond to a request for comment by Reuters to their article. Now, CN, very similar to CS, CN, it's worth noting, is the principal component of the aerosol mace. So that's the kind of effect it can have on you. Now, Moscow previously accused Ukrainian forces of using chemical weapons, something that Kyiv denies. There's no way to independently verify any of that. But Colonel Pakhomov said 500 Ukrainian troops have required medical help after exposure to toxic substances on the battlefield, and at least one soldier has died after suffocating on tear gas. He said, in addition to demoralization, the person loses physical capabilities. He can't see, can't breathe. Everything is irritated. Yes, it's temporary, but it is the very moment the enemy can use to take over this position or another. Now, the Ukrainian military is said to be distributing gas masks or respirators, to use the military term, and conducting drills to prepare soldiers to defend their position and carry on normal military duties during such attacks. But Reuters note that at one drill near Kharkiv, instructors said that the gas masks help protect troops from almost all combat poisons, but the length of exposure could impact their effectiveness. And what they mean by that is that these things, these big, you know, rubberized gas masks, respirators, it's uncomfortable to wear. You can't see an awful lot. Your vision is very degraded. Trying to drink, there's normally a drinking straw with these things, but it's a right old faff to do that. So you get debilitated very, very quickly. We used to call them the black leech in the British Army because these things are just stuck on your face. And you know, in order to show you how degraded you are in the full chemical biological suit, so the black leech on your face and also the clothing you have to wear, the instructors would make us put all the gear on and play football, which is great, great fun. You know, you could have as much water as you like, but you'd play football and basically people passing out all over the place because it's you get so hot so quickly, you can't see what's going on, you can't hear. It's just awful to be in that situation for any amount of time. Now, the Reuters article spoke to Volodymyr, 37-year-old doctor at a medical stabilization point in Donetsk. He said gas attack cases have picked up recently. He was seeing an average of 2 soldiers a week. And then a nurse in an army medical unit said that the symptoms she had seen included bitterness in patients' mouths and dizziness. That's literally the taste of the gas. An official with the OPCW did tell Reuters it had received no request for an investigation or technical assistance related to the alleged ban or alleged use of banned chemicals. But the official, who was anonymous, did say, however, the use of riot control agents as weapons by Russian troops was widely debated at the organization's recent meetings. Now, the task of documenting this is falling to the Ukrainian military. That's where they get the 1,400 figure from, but it's very difficult to verify that. And that would undoubtedly be, there'll probably be more, I would imagine. Okay, next one. A couple more from me, David. So the Dutch help. Yesterday, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte tipped to be the next NATO SecGen. He offered to buy Patriot air defence systems from more hesitant allies in order to send them to Ukraine. This comes from our chums over there at The Guardian. He said, we know that many countries are sitting on large piles of Patriot systems, maybe not wanting to deliver it directly. He was speaking at the two-day summit of EU leaders in Brussels. He said, we can buy it from them. We can deliver it to Ukraine. We have the money available. It's crucial. Well, off you go then. off you go, Mark. Come on, you haven't met 2% of GDP for the Netherlands, but off you go. Anyway, that's just me. Now, earlier yesterday, NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg also urged allies to ramp up their efforts to supply Kyiv with additional air defence. He said, the reality is that, of course, we have systems available that are big enough to enable us to deliver significantly more to Ukraine when it comes to air defence in general, and that's exactly what we're working on. There's a lot of work going on here. Don't know how much action there is. Now, Mr. Stoltenberg also said there were fewer than 100 Patriot batteries in Europe, but said NATO as a whole has a significant number. Don't know who else he could be meaning there. Adding, but that's also reflecting the fact that the United States, which is the ally with the most Patriot batteries, has global responsibilities. Okay, fine. Even if there's just a mere 100 batteries in Europe. Okay, let's go nuts. Let's half it. Let's say 50. Why don't you give those to Ukraine? That would make a difference. President Zelensky, you may remember, he's gone public. He said Ukraine needs 25 Patriot systems to protect the entire country from Russian attacks. And Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said he's now focused on securing 7 to protect Ukraine's largest cities. That's the immediate need. So they're looking for 7. Zelensky says 25 would do it. And Jens Stoltenberg is saying there's 100 in Europe alone, never mind the United States. Okay, just leave that one there. Now, I was tagged in a tweet last night by Germany's ambassador to the UK. Miguel Berger said on X, he put a thing out on X saying, immediate action on air defence is a German initiative to provide Ukraine with more air defence equipment. Ministers Annalena Baerbock, she's the foreign minister, and Boris Pistorius, Germany's defence minister, are calling on partners to strengthen Ukraine's air defences as quickly as possible. This weekend, Germany announced it will send Ukraine another Patriot system. Now, that's all good. So I replied, invited Herr Berger onto the podcast. Got no reply. I followed up this morning, rang the embassy to see if he'd come on. And I think it's quite, rather positive. So I've left it with them. Got a good relationship with the guys over there. They are a good bunch. So I trust them when they say they will check his diary and see if he can make some time for us next week. So we might be speaking to Germany's ambassador to the UK next week, David. So you can hold your breath on that one. And I'll take a little pause there. That's the end of the sort of military stuff, David.
Well, thanks very much, Dom. We are lacking Francis Sternley today. So would you talk us through just a couple of the diplomatic updates you've seen before we go to James Rothwell? So Dom Nichols, what are you looking at?
Of course, David. It's no great loss. Right. OK, so dire need. Ukraine is in desperate need of military weapons that are being held up by Congress's failure to pass the funding package, Pentagon leaders said yesterday. This is General Charles Brown, the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's been there, what, 3 or 4 months now? He described the situation in Ukraine as dire and told the House Defense Appropriations Subcommittee that Ukraine is being outmatched by Russia, quote, whether it's munitions, whether it's vehicles, whether it's platforms. Now, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who is sitting alongside General Brown, he told lawmakers that time matters. He said, we're already seeing things on the battlefield begin to shift a bit in Russia's favor. I think we'd agree with that. That's what we've been reporting. He said, we are seeing them make incremental gains. We're seeing the Ukrainians be challenged in terms of holding the line. Joe Biden has urged Congress to pass the aid package and said he would sign the funding package right away, sending a message that, quote, we won't let Iran or Russia succeed. Now then, what else is there? So sticking on the US, on the US aid bill, and I mentioned Germany's Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock a moment ago. She's been speaking to reporters yesterday. She said she's seen signs of hope coming out of the United States after her government pushed for Washington to continue to keep the support for Ukraine. So on the sidelines of a meeting with her G7 counterparts in Italy, Mrs. Baerbock said, in these turbulent times, it's a hopeful sign that there are now signals from the Republicans in the US that support for Ukraine can be continued intensively. Her comments support an op-ed published in the Wall Street Journal yesterday by a Mr. Jay Biden of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, in which he says Russia is intensifying its war against Ukraine with military and non-lethal materiel support from China, Iran and North Korea, and that Russia and its partners pose an increasing threat to NATO. Mr. Biden stressed that US security assistance to Ukraine can address the Russian threat and he called for the US House of Representatives to urgently pass the Ukraine aid bill, which we think is tabled for action anytime between now and Saturday evening. Support for Ukraine can stop Russia from encroaching on America's NATO allies, Mr. Biden said, and such action would prevent US involvement in a hypothetical future conventional war between Russia and NATO. Now then, the supplemental appropriations bill we're talking about, we sort of glibly say $60 billion, but just to drill into it, because it's, you know, going to be voted on, it largely resembles the earlier bill that was passed by the US Senate. It would offer Ukraine $48.3 billion in direct security assistance. Now, of that, $23.2 billion will go to replenish weapons and equipment from US defense stocks. $13.8 billion would be used for the purchase of new weapons and munitions for Ukraine from US manufacturers. And then $11.3 billion would go for continued US support to Ukraine through other US military operations in the region. So, the first two numbers. The vast majority of that money, 23.2 and the 13.8, I won't ask Francis to do the maths because we know that's not his strong suit. But, you know, the vast majority of this money is going to be spent inside the US. I'll just leave that one there. I'll come back to that a bit later. However, can we rely on the United States? In what might be a complete gift to opponents of this bill, Josep Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, said that he regretted that the impact that internal politics, as he says, in the US was having. And he said, we cannot only rely on the US. Now, that word only is important, so I've stressed that. He said, we cannot only rely on the US. He didn't say we can't rely on the US. He said, we cannot only rely on the US. We have to take our own responsibility and stop saying, oh, the US will do it. He is, of course, correct. But I think it would have been more helpful if he'd been banging that particular drum at any point over the last 2 years and 2 months rather than right at this particularly fractious time. However, you know, better late than never, I suppose. Mr. Borrell urged European countries to send their anti-missile systems to Ukraine. He was speaking to reporters at the G7 foreign ministers meeting on the island of Capri in the Gulf of Naples. No doubt the most convenient spot for everyone to get to and a place that would have absolutely minimised the diplomats' carbon footprints. Anyway, Capri was the only place available, I guess. It's got a big conference room. Mr. Borrell told reporters, we have Patriots, we have anti-missile systems, we have to take them out from our barracks where they are just in case and send them to Ukraine where the war is raging. And last one on the sort of external front, David. Microsoft said yesterday that Russia's online campaigns to influence the upcoming US presidential election have kicked into gear in the past 45 days, but at a slower pace than in past elections. A bit loaded there, saying the past elections. Obviously, Russia denies that had anything to do with the 2016 election, but Microsoft think otherwise. In a new report that they put out, cited by Reuters, Microsoft researchers say Russian-linked accounts are disseminating divisive content aimed at US audiences. They say the typical pattern is that posts would typically start with an apparent whistleblower or a citizen journalist posting content on a video channel. Now, they say, and I look to our US listeners to tell me if this, how on the money is this and what these how on the money this is and how what these media outlets, what their gig is, if you like. But Microsoft say that content, originally from a whistleblower or citizen journalist, is uncovered by a network of websites that include, and this is Microsoft's allegation, that include DC Weekly, Miami Chronicle, and the Intel Drop. They say ultimately, after the narrative has circulated online for a series of days or weeks, US audiences repeat and repost this disinformation, likely unaware of its original source. Now, that's fine. It's all a load of hokum, however, as our American cousins might say, because last month the Kremlin promised it would not meddle in November's presidential election. So everything's fine. And I really do need to take a pause there, David.
Well, thank you very much, Dom Nichols. Let's go to Berlin with James Rothwell. James, tell us about spies in Germany.
Hi, everyone. There's a big story related to espionage breaking in Germany today. German police have arrested two suspected Russian agents who appear to have been plotting a series of sabotage attacks on US military bases in Bavaria. That was part of a wider effort to sort of undermine Berlin's support for Ukraine. Now, they're German-Russian citizens, these spies. They're arrested by police commandos in the town of Bayreuth. There's a bit more detail available from German prosecutors. They say that the suspects' names are one Dieter S., in addition to one Alexander J. German authorities tend not to release the last name of suspects, hence those initials. And the allegations essentially say that they carried out surveillance of US military sites in Bavaria that were potential targets for their attack, and that they were planning an attack that would have relied on explosives and arson action as well. Now, this is obviously a very, very serious case, and it's just the latest in a string of security incidents related to Germany. We had the Luftwaffe leaks not so long ago, when a sensitive phone call between German Air Force officers discussing the potential delivery of Taurus missiles to Ukraine got intercepted and disclosed by Russia. There's currently a German intelligence officer going through the courts in Germany in a separate case. He's accused of high treason for passing state secrets to Russia. So the Germans seem to have a real problem with this. Now, today's series of arrests shows that they're taking this extremely seriously. The details of the case suggest that these two alleged saboteurs were in a relatively early stage of planning, where they were sort of casing targets, taking photos and videos. It's less clear how advanced their planning for an actual attack was, but it will make quite disturbing reading, really, for the rest of NATO. It is just another case of a very serious case of Russian espionage in Germany, though fortunately, this one appears to have been nipped in the bud.
And James, can I ask, what's the reaction in Germany been? Have we heard much from politicians? How's it been talked about in the press?
Well, it's caused quite a bit of a shock, basically. German tabloid Bild is describing it as the sort of latest Russian spy thriller to shock the country. And inevitably, it's going to lead to more discussion about the extent to which Germany may have been infiltrated by Russian spies. There's a sort of growing concern in parts of Germany that Russia may view Germany as the sort of weak link in NATO, the most fertile ground for planting spies and trying to get hold of sensitive information. We've seen some evidence of that already, pretty compelling evidence, in fact, not just that trial I mentioned earlier involving the officer in the German Foreign Intelligence Service, but also that sensitive leak I discussed a moment ago. But this is, or appears at least, to be very much a case of an attack being foiled in, it seems, relatively early stages of its planning. Now, had it gone ahead, of course, this would have been absolutely catastrophic. The focus of this alleged sabotage plan appears to have been US military bases that were involved in supporting Ukraine. So, for example, a focus of German police's investigations has been an area of Bavaria where there are some US military facilities, including those that train Ukrainian soldiers. So in addition to not only damaging military sites, I think one can presume the idea here too was also to cause massive embarrassment to Germany. So it is, I'm afraid, another case of deep concern about the extent to which Germany has been infiltrated, as I said, by Moscow's spies.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, James, for bringing us that. Just one final question. If we zoom out from the spy story you've been covering, what's the tenor of conversation in Germany, in the German public, in the media, in the politicians around Ukraine at the moment? We haven't spoken for a while, so it might be good just to get your sense of where the conversation's going.
Yes, so the foreign policy discussion in Germany at the moment is really dominated by Iran. And after the sort of build-up to the Iranian attack last week, that's kind of where the focus has shifted. Germany, on the whole, is a country that, I think we've talked about this before, has a chancellor who feels he's making very large financial contributions to the support of Ukraine. And one sometimes gets the impression he feels that should get him off the hook for more military provisions, such as the Taurus missiles we've talked about before. They are, I think, engaging more closely on this than they have before. They would point to, for example, artillery production being stepped up. But I think the big concern in Germany, which mirrors that perhaps of the United Kingdom and other NATO members is that it might actually be too late now in order to provide Ukraine with the weapons that they've got. There's some quite alarming dispatches, as you know, coming from reporters who've been embedded with Ukrainian forces on the Eastern Front, who's saying that the soldiers there just haven't got the kit and the gear that they need. That's becoming a sort of increasingly common refrain. And so for that reason, I don't really detect a great deal of optimism, frankly, in Germany about the sort of trajectory of this war. And I think we're just going to have to see where it leads, basically.
Well, James Rothwell, thank you so much for joining us. It's really good to speak to you again. And best of luck with the rest of the day. I know you have to jump off and go do some other reporting. So thank you so much, James.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
James, let's go now to Asami Terayima. Asami, thank you so much for joining us. It was lovely to meet you properly in Kyiv when we were there earlier this year. Just for our listeners, could you just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your work?
Sure. I'm a reporter at the Kyiv Independent. I'm based in Kyiv, but I usually go to the east and the south for reporting, so that I usually report about the frontline situation and the conditions that soldiers are facing 2 years into the war.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's jump in. You were in Donetsk looking at the issue of medical evacuation. So that's soldiers injured in the fighting and the task faced by the medics and their supporters to bring them out of that and get them help. Why did you want to look at this story?
I lost a friend. He died in November 2023. But so there were three friends killed at the moment. But the last one, he was alive for 30 minutes. But of course, there were no medics around. There was no equipment to evacuate him. So he just died on the spot. Of course, there's no guarantee he would have survived if he was evacuated on time. But I mean, there's always the chance. So that made me want to look into the issue.
Can you paint us a bit of a picture of reporting from the front? Where did you go and what did you see?
I went to multiple hotspots of the war, including Avdiivka area, Bakhmut area, Kupiansk areas. And what I found was that really a lot of soldiers go to the front line knowing that there won't be a medical evacuation. There's very low chance that if they receive a serious injury, that they would be evacuated in time. It usually takes hours or sometimes even days for the wounded to get to the medics. And it just, it's just compounding issues. It's not just one issue. Just a lot of things are just not working. It's extremely first demoralizing when you know you're fighting for your country, but then there's no guarantee of medical evacuation. Basically, some of the soldiers have said that they know that they're going to meet death when they go to position each time.
Can we get into the details then? Why does it take so long? What are the issues faced by the medics?
So the first and foremost is the intensity of fighting. Of course, this is a very intense war. Both sides are intensively using their drones and artillery, so it's very difficult for any equipment or even a group of people to get to the spots of fighting. And some soldiers have said that it even takes a day or two to actually get to their position. So that really quickly kills any hope of them being evacuated, because medics are not going to take a day or two to actually get to the position so they can help the wounded. And the second point is that there is just a critical lack of equipment that Ukraine is facing. The war in Ukraine, the front line extends more than 1,000 kilometers, and it's just so much equipment is needed because they are just lost in huge numbers. But the Western allies are not giving enough. And Ukraine has received over 2,000 armored vehicles, which could be used for evacuation. But it's destroying huge numbers or damaged trees, because Russia has a lot of artillery and they're very good at targeting equipment. And and Ukraine just has to keep up with repairing them. So it's only a surface of their needs. And that's why the deficit, according to some soldiers that I've spoken to, they said that in their units of about 300 to 600 men, battalions that are deployed on the hottest spots of the war, they only have one or two armored vehicles. And that's a really bad, that's a really bad situation, because those vehicles are also used not just for evacuation, but also to redeploy the troops. So that means when there's a wounded, there's a high chance that that vehicle might be occupied, so no one can really come to get you. And it usually takes at least 2-3 kilometers usually to hike to the position, because the equipment can't get closer because of the intensity of the fire. But sometimes soldiers have to drag the wounded 5-7 kilometers. That's hours. It takes hours. And they're really easy to spot, because if you have a group of 2-4 men trying to drag the wounded on a stretcher, that's very easy for FPV drones to just struck, and more will be killed.
Asami, could you tell us a little more about the soldiers you met? Who are they? What are their stories?
I've heard a lot of stories, but I think the one that really struck out to me was how, when there is no hopes of evacuation, the guys that are waiting to be evacuated, they call artillery on themselves, because there is just no hope. They won't make it alive, so they want to kill as many Russian soldiers as possible, even if facing death themselves. So that's a really it's really brutal for the local commanders who are receiving this order. Who have soldiers asking them to call artillery on these positions where their comrades are, because for the local commanders, it's basically like killing your comrades. So in those cases, they were trying to evacuate the wounded, as for hours and hours, but it just didn't work, and Russian soldiers got so close, and they eventually occupied this position. So it just, there was no hope. And in such situations, there are cases when Ukrainian soldiers do go artillery on themselves. And one other example was how in March, one former company commander from the 67th Brigade, who was then deployed near Bakhmut, he said that there was a day in March in 2023 where 23 soldiers were stuck on the front line, and they called for, they were trying to evacuate them, to get to them for the whole day, but it didn't work. They had no artillery to also suppress Russian soldiers so that equipment can arrive, or last ditch evacuation just failed because there was nothing to shoot them with and there was no equipment to really get there. So 23 soldiers were there, and they called artillery on themselves. The artillery didn't hit, but the bodies of the 23 guys are still missing to this day. And the youngest of them is 20 years old. So it's a really heartbreaking situation.
Asami, you've painted quite a bleak picture on the state of medical evacuation for Ukrainian troops. What is being done to fix this? What did you find?
What could really solve this issue is if Western allies provide a lot more of the equipment, especially the M113 armored personal vehicles that are there are plenty of them in Western stocks. But unfortunately, Ukraine has a long list of its needs, and according to sources close to the defense ministry, the ammunition remains number one priority. And of course, it's more effective, according to them, that Ukraine sticks to a short list other than a long listicle. And there's just so many things that Ukraine needs. For example, air defense missiles, that's Ukraine is already lacking them, because we see that Russia is stepping up its attacks on energy infrastructure. So equipment is just gets lower and lower into this. So the defense ministry of Ukraine did say that they have requested equipment, including M113s, to Western allies, but they haven't disclosed how many they requested or how many more are being used right now. But for example, US has thousands of M113s sitting in storage, but according to OSINT project Oryx, they said that US has thus far delivered only around 600. So it just, and the Pentagon spokesman has told me that they are aware of this, they are fully aware of the urgency of the situation, but so far we're just waiting for the crucial equipment to arrive.
Asami, in your time out on the front, talking to soldiers and reporting on this, was there anything that surprised you? Did you find what you expected? Were there different things about this that stood out to you?
For the whole 2 years of the war, I mean, like, poor evacuation and just evacuation not really happening. But I didn't realize the extent of the problem. And I just think that it's especially heartbreaking when, for example, when you're lucky enough to be evacuated from, you know, from the position in, like, a relatively short period of time. But there's also the issue of not having enough doctors in the frontline areas who can perform difficult surgeries. So even if you made it, it doesn't mean that, you know, there will be someone to take care of you, to provide you with the surgery that you need. So there are also cases where it's less likely, but there are also wounded soldiers who arrived at the stabilization point, the makeshift hospital, on time, but there weren't enough surgeons to take care of you because there were many other wounded soldiers. And the problem is that Ukraine is already facing a critical manpower shortage because it's, unlike Russia, because it's really struggling to refill the losses that it's taken over the past 2 years. So every soldier lost to a poor evacuation is another that it has to replace.
Asami, thanks so much for joining us today. Storm here. On the home front, in society at large, has there ever been a kind of national coordinated campaign to get civilians to donate blood? When we visited in February, there was not. I'd been chatting to a friend in Kyiv about this, and so I was kind of kept my eyes open for posters, even if they were quite old or what have you. And I couldn't see anything, and I didn't hear any. I'd never heard of any kind of national campaign. Is there such a thing? Is there a culture of blood donation in Ukraine from civil society?
So there are local, like, NGOs, smaller scale. They're trying to get as many, like, you know, people to donate blood. But the thing is, like, Ukraine has a very complicated system of, like, donating blood. So for like 5 days you can't do this and that. They give you so many restrictions that people are not wanting to, like, really donate, because they would donate if it's much easier. But in places like Kherson region or in Kharkiv, I did see some reports that the local authorities are asking for blood donation, because after the attacks, I mean, they just need more blood. But I mean, I haven't really seen a massive national campaign to donate blood. But as far as I know, that's not one of the main issues faced on the front line itself. It's more that people just can't, the wounded just cannot get to the makeshift hospital on time.
Yeah, so looking at the front line, if we may, maybe stepping slightly back from the medical side specifically, but you know, you're a journalist, you obviously know what's going on many different areas geographically as well as sort of policy. How is news filtering through to the people right at the front? Are they up to date with what is going on? And in particular, I'm interested in the mobilization bill that's currently working through the Ukrainian parliament, or just been passed actually by the Ukrainian parliament, now waiting for sign off by President Zelensky. Were people aware of the specifics of that bill? Do they have a view? Are they generally able to stay up to date with the news?
I think it really depends, especially like if it's a mobilization bill. I think the men who are of the mobilization conscription age, they are likely to, like, you know, look into it more, because it's really, it personally affects them very much. But I think that with the local, I mean, like, people that live, people in Kyiv or in other cities that are farther from the front line, I mean, it just, I think they're just really exhausted from the war. And of course, soldiers are more exhausted, but I don't see that, you know, like, all of them are keeping up with news. It's like many, there are some people who are keeping up with news very closely, but then others are, they have their life and they're just living, and it just, I sometimes feel that with certain people, war is in the background. So it's really, I think that, you know, after the war, there will be huge gaps between the soldiers who fought and the people who remained in their homes, not really, you know, contributing to the war. Because there are many other ways to contribute, but I mean, there are people who are just not contributing, and then people who fled abroad. I think that there will be, like, huge gaps post-war, because as we see, like, across the country, people are being affected on a different scale. It's very different individually, I think, but it's normal that some people are more affected than others, and we don't want more people to be affected. But it just, I think, post-war, or even like in later stage in the active phase of the war, I think it will be very problematic.
Asami, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything we haven't spoken about that you think is important for our listeners to hear?
I would just say that, you know, the situation in Ukraine on the front line is just getting worse and worse. The energy attacks are just continuing across the country. But on the front line, we can say that Russia is, you know, it's already, like, preparing for larger offensive, and Russia can take more of Avdiivka. So, you know, we are just, I think, waiting for the Western aid to pass, because otherwise, I mean, Ukraine is already, I mean, even with the Western aid, I think the situation is very dire this year. So without it, I can't really imagine how, I mean, it's very tough to speak how top, how much harder and worse it's going to get on the front line.
Well, Sami, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really interesting and rather bleak listening to your reporting. Congratulations on all your fantastic work. We'll come back to you for a final thought, but let's go to Dom Nichols first. Dom.
Thanks, David. Well, with that in mind, that literally the effect it's having on the front line, let's go back to the bill that is hopefully going to be through Congress by the end of the weekend, voted on by Saturday, we think. Now, then, in an extraordinary and quite brazen about turn, asked why he was putting the bill forward now, Speaker Mike Johnson said on C-SPAN yesterday, great quote, isn't this? My philosophy is you do the right thing and let the chips fall where they may. History judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now. Providing lethal aid for Ukraine right now is critically important. We can't play politics with this. I mean, wow. Just wow. After everything he's done or not done, to come out with statements like that is just extraordinary. Say it with a straight face. I think Mike Johnson is the living embodiment of the saying that's been attached to the United States when it comes to foreign policy, that America will always do the right thing, having exhausted every other possibility. You just know Mike Johnson is the kind of guy who owns novelty undercrackers with Make Johnson Great Again printed on the front, just for birthdays and date nights, I guess. We've all met guys like him. But I mean, I just couldn't believe that. Have a look at it on, you'll see it on social media, that the way he could say this with a straight face. But, you know, seriously, this is a pivotal moment. And I said earlier about how much of the money of this bill is going to be staying in the United States, going directly to US defense firms. So that argument about US taxpayer money, you know, hemorrhaging out of the country is a busted flush. But, and if I may be so presumptuous as to address any US politicians listening, regardless of how you feel about Ukraine, if you don't vote this bill through and Putin wins this war, you won't be affected, but your grandkids easily might. Even those who wouldn't choose a career in the military could easily find themselves drafted into uniform in the not-too-distant future to serve on operations standing up to emboldened autocrats, if not in Europe, then the South China Sea. And I just note, I was thinking about it this morning, there's an old British adage, which I repeat here, as a friend to the US, with very, very dear friends of mine in the US, nations have no permanent friends and no permanent enemies, only permanent interests. Believe that or not, agree with it or not. But, you know, to US lawmakers right now, your interests lie in seeing Russia defeated today in Ukraine.
Thank you very much, Dom Nichols. Asami, as our guest, would you like the very final words?
Yes, I mean, I think that, you know, if this bill doesn't pass, I mean, as soon as possible, the longer we wait, the longer the US Congress waits to pass the bill, then I think the consequences are really heavily felt on the ground. As we saw, I mean, we lost the Avdiivka, not just because of this, but also, like, it's just compounding issues. The situation is just getting worse, and we just don't, we're just running out of ammunition and people and these other weapons and equipment every single day. So time is very crucial, and it's also a matter of Ukrainian soldiers' lives.
Thank you so much, Dom, James and Asami. Here's a clip of Mike Johnson speaking about the Ukraine bill that Dom referenced in his final thoughts.
My philosophy is you do the right thing and you let the chips fall where they may. If I operated out of fear over a motion to vacate, I would never be able to do my job. Look, history judges us for what we do. This is a critical time right now, a critical time on the world stage. I could make a selfish decision and do something that that's different, but I'm doing here what I believe to be the right thing. I think providing lethal aid to Ukraine right now is critically important.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/UkraineTheLatest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our world affairs newsletter which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Giles Gear, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.